What we know is that services statewide that were impacted include our wireless service, our local and long-distance service.
A power failure causes phones to go down across the state. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 9th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, immigrant detention centers with ties to Alaskan Native corporations.
Armed ground transport, and it went to a Bering Straits Native Corporation subsidiary.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
A power source failure in Anchorage this morning caused service issues for GCI customers across the state. According to GCI spokesperson Heather Handyside, the outage happened between 4:30 and 5 a.m. near company headquarters.
What we know is that services statewide that were impacted include our wireless service, our local and long-distance service. We have had some reports of video service being interrupted in southeast communities, and we have some interruptions to internet services in the Anchorage area.
Handyside said a backup power system failed after several hours following the outage, but kicked in again by mid-morning. In a statement, GCI said the original problem was connected to a transformer provided through Anchorage-based electric utility Municipal Light and Power. According to MLNP, they have since replaced the transformer and are trying to determine the exact cause of the outage. As of around 4 p.m. today, GCI said it had restored wireless, local, and long-distance service, with the majority of internet services back statewide as well. However, the company says it is still working on returning TV access in Juneau, Kodiak, Sitka, and Valdez. Some of the outrage over the separation of families at the southern border has spilled over to the government contractors who work in migrant detention, and several of those contracting companies are Alaska Native corporations. Here to explain why that is, Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin joins us. Hello, Liz.
Hey, Zach.
So to start out, what kinds of work are these companies doing?
Well, I combed through the government contracts database to find out what kind of work they did. So I looked at recent contracts for ICE. I found a NANA subsidiary that got a $22 million contract for detention management at Chrome. That's an ICE detention facility near Miami. The same subsidiary got a contract of $8 million for detention support services in upstate New York. There was an Otna subsidiary that got a recent ICE contract for $35 million to provide guard services at a facility in Texas. And another Alaska Native Corporation subsidiary runs an ICE detention center in San Pedro, California. Also, I saw one for armed ground transport, $700,000, one of the smaller ones, and it went to a Bering Straits Native Corporation subsidiary.
Liz, a lot of these terms sound kind of vague. I mean, is there more details available in the records that you're looking at for what a lot of these functions actually are?
No, there's not a lot of detail in the database. So, I don't know. By the size of the contract, I can sort of assume that one of these corporations isn't running the whole facility because the contract amount is too small. So I don't know if when they say guard services, they mean across the whole facility or are they only guarding the perimeter. You know, there's just a lot of details that aren't in this database.
Well, and that brings up another question. I saw an article by the Daily Beast recently about Otna saying that the company got $800 million to run a detention center in Texas. Is that the full picture?
Well, I don't doubt their story, but I didn't see an $800 million contract to run one center. They have, over the years, had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts from ICE. But I didn't see one for that amount. So I'm not sure how they're adding it up to get to $800 million. But there's a lot of room in this database to slice and dice in different ways.
Well, and a lot of the numbers that you mentioned are still pretty big, even if they're not $800 million. This seems like quite a bit of money coming into ANCs from federal contracts, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but the important thing to know, these are big contracts, but of course, when a company gets a contract to, say, run an ICE detention facility, then they have to hire all the people that are actually going to run the detention facility. So it's not like it's all profit coming to the ANC.
Why is it ANCs that are doing so much of this work?
A lot of the ANCs got into government contract work because through the 8A program, the small business program, ANCs can get sole source contracts of unlimited size. So a lot of the Native corporations got into government contracting through that program. And mostly they've been contracting with the Department of Defense. And I discovered today that Homeland Security is the next biggest one. It's well behind Department of Defense, but quite a few Native corporation subsidiaries have Homeland Security contracts.
And what have you heard from some of the ANCs that are involved in this contracting?
Well, I actually didn't reach a single ANC. I did talk to someone who's peripherally involved in Native contracting. And the word that I got is their contracts specifically say that they can't talk to the press. So it's perhaps not too surprising.
Okay. Well, Liz, thanks for your reporting and take care.
Thanks a lot.
An Alaska State Trooper who fatally shot a Copper Center man Friday has been identified as a 6-year veteran of the force. Glen Allen-based trooper Kaumau Lay shot Eric Hash at a Copper Center residence at about 3 a.m. Friday. According to the trooper's family members called saying Hash had assaulted one person and others were in fear of being hurt. Troopers say Lay fired on Hash as he advanced toward his patrol vehicle with a container of what they call an incapacitating flammable liquid. Hash died after being medevaced to a hospital. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation is looking into the shooting, after which the Office of Special Prosecution will make a determination on whether deadly force was justified. Trooper Lay was one of five officers involved in a September 2015 shooting in Fairbanks. 33-year-old Vincent Perdue was killed and 20-year-old Sarah Smoke was injured in a shooting which came at the end of a vehicle chase during which Perdue and Smoke had fired on pursuing officers. The waters of the Kuskokwim River have opened to subsistence gillnet fishing 24 hours, 7 days a week. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in consultation with the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission, lifted its federal restrictions on Friday. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
This action places the entire Kuskokwim River drainage under state jurisdiction. Following this action, state managers issued a news release that allows gillnets to be used in open areas until further notice. Chairman of the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission, Nick Kamroff, reminded residents at Friday's Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group meeting that king salmon remain under conservation.
And I'd just like to encourage folks during times of conservation, if they would just take what is needed.
The federal and tribal managers rescinded federal restrictions based on the conclusion that most of the king salmon run has passed through the lower river. By the state's estimates, 87% of the king salmon run had passed Bethel by Friday based on historical run timing. Now, chum and red salmon compose most of the species in the river. Over last week, an average of 17 chums and reds had been caught for every one king salmon at the state-operated Bethel test fishery. The federal government took over management of the federal waters of the lower Kuskokwim River on June 12th of this year to restrict king salmon harvest to subsistence families living along the river. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists are looking into whether or not great white sharks are lurking off Alaska's shores.
And within, I think, 5 minutes, we got a response back. This is classic shark bite.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The ongoing power struggle within the Calista Corporation's upper leadership came to a stalemate on Friday night. After hours of public comments at a particularly tense annual meeting, shareholders opted to maintain the Calista Regional Native Corporation's current balance of power. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis has more.
Calista's board election was the latest in a series of increasingly public debates over who should lead this corporation. CEO Andrew Guy and former chairman Wayne Dawn have been trying to push each other out of Calista for most of the past year, and the corporation's infighting has grown increasingly brutal. Calista is currently suing Dawn to forcibly remove him from its board of directors, and the corporation and its CEO were sued in turn last week in a sexual harassment case. If the board had swung in Wayne Dawn's favor, then he might have been able to urge Calista's board to dismiss the lawsuit against him. As it stands now, he says he'll have to fight it out in court. We caught up with Dawn after the meeting. He was eating dinner with friends at Connie's in Bethel.
From a principle and responsibility standpoint, you know, that's the right thing to do. I maintain that I followed the rules. I followed my responsibilities, and I take my fiduciary responsibility very seriously.
He added that, quote, he'll continue to advocate for that until this thing is resolved. While he doesn't know Shira personally, Dawn says he looks forward to working with her. She's an accounting and financial professional, and he says she understands the importance of due diligence.
I trust that, you know, she understands the role directors have to be independent, and we'll hope that she continues to serve in that capacity as being a positive person on the board.
The political struggle between Wayne Dawn and Andrew Guy can be traced back to a series of hair-raising sexual harassment allegations in 2017, which Dawn and his supporters argue Guy mishandled. In a lawsuit filed last week, Colorado businesswoman Tiffany Phillips claims that she was repeatedly sexually harassed by George Aulituck, a former Calista top executive and close friend of Andrew Guy's. When she complained to Guy about how she was treated, he apologized to her but didn't refer her case to Calista's human resources department like he was supposed to. Dawn tried to raise concerns about how Guy handled Phillips' complaint at a Calista board meeting last December, but several board members quickly shut him down. Guy and his supporters have been trying to push Dawn out of the corporation ever since. While shareholders didn't tilt Calista's board of directors in Dawn's favor on Friday, they did have plenty of questions for Calista's leadership. Dawn said that at least 20 to 30 people publicly supported him during the meeting.
Obviously, just being on the other end of that, I'm very appreciative of that.
Many shareholders seemed particularly angered by the way Guy might have handled the sexual harassment allegations against his friend George Aulituck. Calista repeatedly reprimanded Aulituck for harassment during his short time at the corporation, and during the annual meeting, a former Calista employee told shareholders that Aulituck had harassed her too when she worked there. These weren't the only issues Calista shareholders debated on Friday. Constituents also approved the formation of an Alaska Native Settlement Trust by a wide margin, and many constituents also publicly opposed the Donlin Gold Mine, which would be built on land that Calista owns the mineral rights to. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
The Alaska Aerospace Corporation launched a subsidiary, Aurora Launch Services, last week. It'll focus on providing support for customers to launch vehicles with smaller satellite payloads into orbit. And it'll also be cheaper, says Craig Campbell, president and CEO of Alaska Aerospace, because they won't use state employees anymore. Instead, they'll hire contractors for services on demand.
Now you're only paying for the launch services when you need the launch services. So one of the problems we've had in the past, or one of the costs we've had in the past, has been keeping a large employee force paid on payroll even when we had no launches. And by going to Aurora, now you only contract for the services when you have a customer that's going to launch from your facility.
He says the company is wholly owned by AAC. After its 2014 launch failure, the corporation went 2 years without a launch and laid off many employees. But Campbell says now business is coming back.
The best way to now be able to address the business that we're getting is to just pay by the drink. Bring on the people you need for the launch time that you need them and not have to pay them year-round. It also is an opportunity to provide more Alaskans jobs, and specifically for people that live in Kodiak.
Most jobs will be in launch operations or facility maintenance, says Campbell. There will also be a handful of full-time employees and then a number of part-time employees that will be flexible and determined by contracts. He says that the corporation hopes to continue range and telemetry services for a New Zealand launch site as well, as well as add an equatorial launch site in Hawaii or the Mariana Islands in order to offer both polar and equatorial launches. John Kramer will serve as the subsidiary's president. He says there's no other company that'll be able to do what Aurora will do.
The subsidiary will be able to provide launch services for any customer, any place in the world, who has a desire to bring in a team to be able to launch their vehicles.
Kramer says that Aurora should be fully operational within the year, and he adds that they could hire their first employees over the next couple of months. Passengers were stranded Thursday on a ferry tied up in Angoon for 7 hours after it lost power. In that time, they were fed the galley's melting ice cream, a fatal dog fight ensued, and a seafood dinner donated by a local lodge ended up uneaten in the ship's freezer. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
The ferry had been stuck in Angoon with 52 passengers aboard for nearly 6 hours. That's when one of them, Kathleen Dean Moore, left KTOO's newsroom this voicemail.
I am on board the Lakanti, the ferry that is in dock in Angoon. It has lost electrical power. It is unable to open the gate that would let the people from Angoon go home.
The ferry's primary generator failed, and the stern door was unable to open.
And the people in Angoon were beside themselves because their friends were waving and beckoning, and they weren't able to get off the ferry. They weren't able to get off the ferry for hours and hours and hours.
It didn't help that it was also one of the hottest days of the year.
Things got bad on board because without electricity, the toilets didn't flush, and so the toilets were filling up nasty stuff.
Ferry officials confirmed that the Lakanti was without power for about 7 hours.
It was an unprecedented and difficult situation without any power.
Orlando is the spokeswoman for the state's ferry system.
The cooling systems on board for the food and water systems were not working. So what the crew did is they first gave away all the ice cream because that was going to melt, made sure there were liquids available. They passed out sandwiches and food.
People brought pets up from the car deck. By this time, Moore recalled, tempers were frayed, and one person's two dogs began fighting.
It was very difficult for people to take care of their dogs. As you can imagine, it was really sweltering hot, and people were going down and trying to keep them from suffering. But one dog seriously bit another dog, and the little dog died on deck.
The State Department of Transportation had a technician flown in from Juneau. Mark Powers was waiting for a grocery delivery and offered his boat to help.
We got the mechanic aboard with the skiff. They were able to open the side door, but they couldn't open the stern doors of the ship.
On board, Powers said he saw how desperate things were getting. The captain and crew had their hands full. He co-owns the Whaler's Cove Lodge with his wife and figured they could help.
I called over to him and offered to get everybody fed. We didn't really know it till about that time that they didn't have any electricity to the galley, so they were down to, I think, just bread and a couple cases of bottled water.
The lodge's staff sprang into action.
We pulled a bunch of crab out of our crab tanks and cooked them up and did some hotel pans and took them all over there. And
by this time, repairs to the generator were complete and the power was back on. The doors were opened and Angoon passengers were off the ship. But there were still about 30 passengers bound for Juneau. Kathleen Moore recalls sighting the dinner boat.
We were all excited because we saw that the lodge there was bringing over a skiff that was filled with a feast, and it had crab and I think it was salad, I don't know it, but big trays of this food. And we thought, hooray, they're going to feed us and treat us well. They brought that food on board and it disappeared and we never saw it. So what we had to eat was a sandwich. Oh yeah, and a scoop of ice cream.
Ferry spokeswoman Orlando confirmed the crab dinner was never served.
The crab came aboard right when the power came back on, and so the crew was working on getting passengers off in Angoon and then getting underway to get back to Juneau. So it was late at night, and they put the crab in the freezer so that they could run the boat and get the operations going.
She added the captain had decided that if the generator couldn't be restarted before dark, he'd risk putting passengers on lifeboats. They wouldn't spend the night aboard the disabled ferry. Mechanical failures aboard the ferries are not uncommon. Lando said there are a number of reasons, the aging fleet, plus a $29 million cut in state funding over the past 5 years. The Lakanti eventually arrived in Juneau at 4:15 in the morning, 8 hours late. At 10 a.m., it was back in service on a run to Haines and Skagway. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A judge has approved a $275,000 settlement for the family of a Juneau Elementary School student injured in gym class. Court documents said the Harborview Elementary fourth grader was hit in the face by a soccer ball in 2016. The youngster suffered a concussion and was permanently blinded in one eye. The family sued in February, accusing the elementary physical education teacher of negligence. Outside the courtroom, the family's attorney, Matt Singer, said Monday the $275,000 settlement is appropriate.
The settlement is a product of negotiation and compromise between the parties. The case involved an unfortunate and significant injury, and we think it reflects a fair compromise for both parties.
The family isn't being named out of concern for the child's privacy. Judge Trevor Stevens approved the terms of the settlement Monday in Juneau Superior Court. Clay Keene is the Ketchikan-based attorney retained by the city. He said the school district admits no wrongdoing.
The Juneau School District admits no fault. There was no fault. And the decision to settle this matter was a business decision on the part of the district and the CBJ.
The city is partially insured. Jennifer Mannix, Juneau's risk assessment officer, said the total cost to Juneau taxpayers will be $250,000, by far the largest payout in recent years.
I don't know of another claim like this that's happened for some time with the city or the school district.
The net proceeds of the six-digit settlement will be held in trust until the child turns 18 years old.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Climbing season on Denali is now over. According to the National Park Service, there are no more mountaineering or ranger teams on North America's tallest peak. Out of just over 1,100 climbers, 45% reached the summit of Denali this season. That summit rate could see some adjustment as Park Service staff verifies the accounts. While the number is slightly below average, one statistic thankfully stayed at zero this year. According to Denali National Park spokeswoman Maureen Galtieri, there have been no fatalities in the Alaska Range this season. She says this is the first time in 15 years that there's not been either a medical or climbing-related death on Denali. While the season is done on Denali, climbing in the Alaska Range will continue in various forms. The annual climbing summary includes statistics on search and rescue operations and a medical summary, as well as sections on new climbing routes and interesting climbs. The 2018 report will be completed and released in the coming months. International seafood buyers are scheduled to visit Unalaska this month, but they don't hail from a massive importer like China or Japan. Instead, they're coming from Ukraine, a once modest market for Alaska's fish that's slowly reemerging after political upheaval and economic crisis. KUCB's Laura Craigle has more.
In 2013, Ukraine spent $100 million on American seafood, a record for the Eastern European nation that loves hake, pollock, and salmon roe. But 2 years later, those imports had plummeted by more than 200% as the Ukrainian government was overthrown and parts of its land occupied by Russia. Today, the country's political conflicts are ongoing, but inflation and income have stabilized enough that foreign fish is back on the menu.
The Ukrainian market is a growing market for U.S. seafood exports, and therefore it makes sense for Alaska to be part of that presence.
Jeremy Woodrow works for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. He says ASME is organizing the Ukrainian visit to rebuild trade relationships that will hopefully pay off down the road.
It's definitely not as large as, say, Japan or China and maybe some other countries in Europe, but it is a growing market, and it's always good to have new customers and a growing demand for our products. It creates competition, and competition usually helps drive value.
Woodrow says the six Ukrainian delegates represent companies that are eager to connect with Alaska seafood suppliers. They'll tour processing plants and fishing boats in Unalaska before making stops in Juneau and Seattle.
They'll be interested in seeing some of the larger fisheries like pollock, as well as some of the groundfish fisheries like halibut and cod. And of course, it's going to be salmon season during the summertime when they're here, and so they'll see how that operates across the state.
While the delegates develop contacts in Alaska, Woodrow says Ukraine's political landscape shouldn't present any new obstacles. He doesn't expect anything like the new tariffs levied by China. And in fact, he says an ongoing Russian embargo on American food is only boosting interest in Alaska fish.
We've actually seen some of that shift from Russia go to countries like Ukraine, who are similar customs and similar preferences with their diets. And that's where we've seen some of our industry shift their focus. And that's why it tends to be a growing market right now.
The Ukrainian delegation will be in Unalaska July 22nd through 25th. Then heading to Juneau and Seattle at the very end of the month. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
There's only one historical record of a great white shark in the Bering Sea. Fishermen caught one in those waters, but it was nearly 40 years ago. Now, scientists have reason to believe that in recent years, there might be more of the predators around. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
In the past 3 years or so, Brandon Amosik says something strange has been opening its jaws to marine mammals in the Bering Sea. Think chewed-off flippers and large bite marks. Some seals were beheaded. Amosik is a subsistence coordinator at Kowarik, the nonprofit arm of the Bering Straits Regional Native Corporation. And he says killer whales have been known to maim their prey. But the bite marks that have been showing up recently look clean. Killer whales tend to tear their food apart, which got Amosik thinking. Could this be a great white shark?
When we first started getting pictures of these, so we're asking local fish and game in the fisheries department, could this be a shark attack? And right off the bat, we kind of got laughed at.
Eventually, with the help of Alaska Sea Grant, the pictures were sent off to a shark expert in Hawaii.
And within, 5 minutes, we got a response back. This is classic shark bite.
Beyond just the bites, a couple of hunters spotted a large predator in the water about 7 years ago. They were on the south side of St. Lawrence Island in December. It had been a warm year, and sea ice hadn't developed on that side of the island yet. Amosik says the hunters were looking for seal when they saw a stellar sea lion leap out of the water.
Trying to get his butt to the island as fast as he can. And before it got to the island, came out of the water, and then all of a sudden it got hit from underneath, and they see a shark hitting it and then going down. Nothing else came up after that, but the water was just red.
The hunter saw what appeared to be a 16-foot-long shark, which is consistent with the size of a great white. Amosik estimates there's been about 20 reports of seal maimings. And scientists are still trying to gather more information from coastal communities before they can definitively say what's going on. But as the Bering Sea continues to warm, it's not impossible to fathom. More great white sharks could be hanging around. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Kayla DeRoche and Dacia Eaton in Kodiak, Anna Rose MacArthur and Teresa Katsarillis in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.